Welcome back, one and all, to Mr. Armageddon Part 2, The Lead Menace. Do you remember once, a while ago, I spoke about Samuel Taylor Coleridge's person from Porlock? Well, that's exactly what happened to me. I came up with a super awesome title for this show, but I happened to be at the gym at the time, and I didn't write it down, and I have never remembered that idea ever again. All I can remember is that I had a good idea, and not what that good idea was. So I had to go with Bravo Team here. Also, I know that that's technically not what the person from Porlock was, but I like bringing it up because it makes me sound bohemian. Anyway, back to Mr. Armageddon.
It's Historigo time.
When last we spoke, we were looking at how one Thomas Midgley Jr., and to a slightly lesser extent, one Charles Kettering, invented chlorofluorocarbons, also known as the chemical freon, and with that invention, accidentally nearly caused the end of the world. The invention of CFCs was an environmental disaster on a previously unheard-of scale. Never before had humans invented something that could potentially end all life on Earth. Remember, this was in the late 20s, early 30s. We weren't going to split the atom for another decade. And ironically, splitting the atom is pretty much how freon actually works, but nuclear physics does it a whole lot faster.
Isn't that the wrong way?
Yeah, but faster!
Now, in all fairness, Thomas Midgley and Charles Kettering had no idea that their invention was going to destroy the force field that protects the world from evil space lasers. That was just inconceivable. Remember, this is pre-atomic. The idea that humans were capable of building something that could destroy, well, everything, was simply beyond imagination at the time. We've come a long way since then. The point is, they didn't intend to do it. The result was the same, the near destruction of quite literally everything, but they didn't set out to do that while they were chasing short-term profits. It just happened to be an accident. They didn't wake up one morning and say, "Oh, let's destroy civilization." It's just that one thing led to another. And that was the first time that they directly caused a global catastrophe. The second time they did it, though, the second time was entirely their fault. Kettering and Midgley went into that one with both eyes open, and they deliberately killed or injured billions of people because it was going to make them rich. That morning, they did indeed wake up and choose violence. Billions of people. With a B. And it's kind of weird that we're talking about real history here and real things that actually happened, and I can start this show with the first time they nearly caused Armageddon was an accident, the next time they did it on purpose. Most people don't even get one doomsday event. These guys are shooting for End of the World Part 2, Electric Boogaloo. I mean, come on, check your privilege, Tommy.
Bah! He was a rank amateur compared to Dr. Colossus!
Thomas Midgley Jr., under the instruction of Charles Kettering, invented tetraethyl lead. And as a direct consequence, in addition to all of the environmental damage and the disease and the sickness and the outright death that that invention caused, in addition to all of that, every single person on this planet over the age of 50, without a single exception, is on average 5 IQ points dumber than they would have been if Thomas Midgley Jr. had never lived. Which goes a long way to explaining the reach and influence of Rupert Murdoch. Boom! How's that for an epic multi-show callback? If you want to know more about how to structure entertainment, my book is on my Linktree. Linktree.com/historygotime. Seriously, I could use the sales. But as ever, we're going to need some context. Most of the crucial context is in the first part of this show, so if you haven't listened to that episode, then maybe go and give that a whirl. It's certainly going to give you some good background. But maybe that's not how you roll. Maybe you love listening to podcasts out of order and with no contextual clues. More power to you. I'm not going to try and teach grandma to suck eggs. I'm just telling you what I would do. But if you're wondering who Thomas Midgley Jr. and Charles Kettering are, it's all in there. And also, let's just take a quick moment to really focus in on the fact that Thomas Midgley Jr. is Thomas Midgley Jr. I mean, come on. The guy did a lot of heinous shit in his life, for sure, but he was obviously up against it from the very beginning. Any parent who names their child after themselves is, categorically, without exception, a piece of shit. I'm going to go on record as saying that's a rule without exception. You name your kid you Junior, you're just not a good person, and there should have been a rule prohibiting you from having children in the first place. Thomas Midgley Jr., Keith Rupert Murdoch Jr., George W. Bush Jr. There you go, three completely random examples chosen totally off the top of my head. See, there is no example in all of history of a junior ever being a good person. Don't research that, just trust me. Anyway, in case you couldn't be asked listening to the previous show, you just need to know that Thomas Midgley Jr. and Charles Kettering were mad scientists.
It's alive!
Well-intentioned mad scientists, sure, but still mad scientists.
Weird science.
And did I include that bit so I could shoehorn in some Oingo Boingo? You tell me.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention?
Here's a random fact for you, go win some trivia. Did you know that the lead singer of Oingo Boingo, Danny Elfman, became a composer of quite some repute? Some of his stellar body of work includes the incomparable Men in Black theme tune, Tim Burton's Batman, and the intro music to some obscure cartoon called The Simpsons.
Well, I just did a ton of research at the library, but I couldn't concentrate. They were blasting Oingo Boingo at top volume.
But this show isn't going to kick off with Danny Elfman, or even Thomas Midgley Jr. for that matter. The crucial context that we're going to need lies with another scientist altogether. A dude by the name of Claire Patterson, and he's one of the more important people in history. So much so that I don't want to spend too much time on him here because there is definitely another show in this, and I always try and leave some work for tomorrow. Keep that powder dry, kids. Claire Patterson is another one of those scientists with a really cool name, although his name is more for esoteric appeal than it is for outright cool, like Professor Sherwood Rowland, who discovered the ozone damage and then, I assume, went off to fight Batman. With a soundtrack provided by Danny Elfman. Man, I am just killing the callbacks today. The Book on Comedy, get into it. If you've ever watched Neil deGrasse High's version of Cosmos, you'd all be familiar with the life and work of Claire Patterson. I was about to recommend that if you have not watched Cosmos, either the Neil deGrasse Tyson version or the Carl Sagan version, you should do that immediately once you finish this show, but I kinda don't want to send you in that direction because then you'll realize how much I straight up plunder from those two, so I don't know, be advised. So Claire Patterson was a scientist in the earlier parts of the 20th century, and he was involved in a little thing known as the Manhattan Project, which is something you should all be familiar with. The Manhattan Project was that one time that the United States assembled all of the smartest people in the world, like the Avengers, and then put them to work creating a weapon that they were not exactly sure would not destroy the entire world, and they still decided to build it anyway. Which, admittedly, is basically any given Tuesday for the Avengers. But in real life, instead of building Ultron, it was a bomb that harnessed the fundamental principles of the universe to create a temporary star over the sovereign nation of Japan. As I've said before on this show, it is crucial to remember that the people involved in the Manhattan Project were not 100% sure that the nuclear reaction would ever stop. It could have kept going. They were pretty sure it was going to stop, but there was still a small chance that the fireball would keep going and melt the entire planet, and they pushed that button anyway.
But I always say, keep your friends rich and your enemies rich and wait to find out which is which.
So maybe all of this should be graded on a curve and Thomas Midgley Jr. wasn't too far removed from his cohorts because some of the smartest people in the history of humanity built a device that could have destroyed Earth, and they pressed that button anyway. But as it turns out, the atomic bomb did not ignite the atmosphere, so hooray for us. But also, there's a terminally ill lunatic with a large stockpile of nuclear weapons out there right now, so it's still a chance. Go and listen to the Ukraine show if you want to know more about that. Anyway, yeah, the Manhattan Project was the development of nuclear weapons. Well, the Allied version of it, anyway. The Nazis were also working on atomic weapons, but Hitler was an idiot who killed all of his best scientists because they were Jews or gays or whatever, so it never took off, and once again, we have to thank history that Hitler was a fucking moron. Albert Einstein? You may have heard of him. Well, he was German. He left Germany because of Hitler. There's an interesting counterfactual to play with. What if Hitler wasn't such a monster that all of his scientists packed up and left? Go and listen to the Hitler show if you want to know more about that. Boost those metrics for me. You know what? I'm starting to get a bit of a back catalog going here. Isn't that cool? Hey, awesome. Find those wins where you can. The Manhattan Project was a who's who of the biggest intellectual players in the history of mankind. You've got Albert Einstein, who is considered the smartest person who ever lived. There's John von Neumann, who could run rings around Einstein. There was Richard Feynman, one of history's biggest cads. Also one of the best physicists ever, but unlike everyone else on this list, Feynman fucked. Leo Szilard, who invented pretty much everything nuclear. Enrico Fermi, who you might recognize for having everything scientific named after him. Seriously, the famous Fermi paradox, he came up with that on his lunch break. He wrote it on the back of a napkin. J. Robert Oppenheimer, who is now a Christopher Nolan film. Maria Meyer, the first woman to win a Nobel Prize for nuclear physics. Qian Wu, aka the First Lady of Physics. Hans Bethe, who mentored the next generation of great scientists like Freeman Dyson. The list just keeps going and going and going. And all of them combined could not do a fraction of the damage to the planet of one Thomas Midgley Jr. And one of the people working on this big bomb was Claire Patterson. Claire Patterson's job was turning uranium-235 into enriched uranium-238, which is a process that I've gone into in more detail in a Patreon-only show, so consider that this episode's prompt. Patrons get to know how to enrich yellow cake for about $5 a month. Think about it. You can ransom the world for a monthly subscription of $5. It pays for itself after the first month.
When the Earth starts to settle, God throws a stone at it. And believe me, he's winding up.
So World War II wraps up with the dropping of two nuclear weapons on Japan, and Claire Patterson suddenly finds himself in a need to find a new job. At this stage, he's pretty young. He hasn't finished his PhD yet. So he decides to use his new knowledge in dicking around with uranium to take on a new project. He's going to figure out the age of the Earth. No big deal, just how old the planet is. That sounds like a pretty good PhD, right? And this isn't as out of the blue as it may sound. Uranium is actually the key to calculating the age of the Earth. It's not as disconnected as it might appear on the surface. Because Claire Patterson was all about that half-life, and not the awesome video games for which we one day might get an episode 3. No, Half-Life Alyx doesn't count because we don't count anything with Rhys Darby in it. Pay attention. So once again, I need to walk the tightrope between educating and patronizing. Because I don't know what you guys all know, and I don't want to leave anyone behind, but I don't want to patronize. Because maybe you don't know this. I'm pretty sure you do, but maybe you don't. Again, I don't want to leave anyone behind, so I'll keep it short. Short and incredibly basic. Don't at me, scientists. Things that are radioactive because they're constantly throwing out subatomic particles. Radiating them, if you will. That's what makes them so damn dangerous. They emit these extra subatomic bits that mess with your subatomic bits, and then the body freaks out and makes cancer. It's like if you're trying to count something, but someone is shouting random numbers at you. Except the trying to count part is making healthy cells, and the shouting numbers is radiation. But these subatomic particles don't come from nowhere. They're already in the atoms of radioactive material. That's thermodynamics. So whenever these atoms shed particles, the atoms become lighter. They have a finite supply. That's why all radioactive materials will eventually decay into less radioactive materials until they become stable and no longer emit radiation. They just run out of stuff to radiate. and that's called a half-life. It's the amount of time it takes for something radioactive to shed enough particles that it is half as big as it used to be. And this half-life depends on how radioactive your material is. It could be years, it could be millennia, it's all about the material. Cobalt-60, which is used in medicine, has a half-life of 5.26 years, so every 5 and a bit years, half of that cobalt-60 will have turned into harmless nickel. Uranium-238, which is our bad boy of nuclear weapons and way more radioactive than cobalt, has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which is slightly more than 5 years. Every 4.5 billion years, half of the U-238 atoms will turn into lead. Good old familiar lead. Well, not exactly, it goes through a few more stages first. Initially it becomes thorium, which will turn into protactinium, and then into 11 other things before it finally turns into normal everyday lead. Lead is still highly toxic, but at least it isn't radioactive anymore. But the thing is, this rate of decay is consistent. It can be measured. It's always 4.5 billion years. It's never 3 billion one time and 5 billion the next. It is always 4.5 billion years on the dot. So Claire Patterson knows all of this because he's a nuclear physicist.
Nuclear. It's pronounced nuclear.
This is precisely his wheelhouse. If you want to know how heavy uranium is, Claire Patterson is your guy. And he knows how to use this knowledge to calculate the age of the Earth. There's a fair bit of science involved here, but essentially he uses zircon to calibrate his Earth birthday machine. Because of science, when zircon crystals are formed, they have a little bit of uranium in them and nothing else. That's just how it is. This isn't geology go time. So if you find some zircon with some lead in it instead of uranium, you know that that zircon is at least 4.5 billion years old. So Claire Patterson and another scientist named George Tilton start measuring the uranium and lead content of zircon crystals. Tilton is measuring uranium, and his measurements are bang on the money. The universe has exactly as much uranium as you would expect it to. At the same time, Patterson starts measuring lead content, and his measurements are all over the fucking charts. There is lead everywhere. Holy shit, is there lead. It is lead all the way down. There is way, way too much lead everywhere. And this alarms Patterson for a few reasons, some of which we'll be exploring further in this show, but most of them revolve around the fact that lead is pure fucking poison. But where is all of this lead coming from? Lead isn't exactly rare, it's a rather common metal, but you don't expect it to be literally everywhere on the planet. So where was all of this lead coming from? This was the question that would torture Claire Patterson for the rest of his life. Why does planet Earth, the planet we all live on, where we keep all of our stuff, why does Earth have so much lead everywhere? We're about to go down a massive rabbit hole of the interconnected web of history, but there is no other way around it, so buckle up. Brace yourselves. I probably should have said that about 20 minutes ago, but here we are. We're going to need to jump in the time-traveling DeLorean again, and this time, where we're going, we're actually going to need roads. Because we're going to travel back to 1908, and we're going to go to Detroit, Michigan. Back in the days before Detroit was the cautionary tale of late-stage capitalism. This is before the Ford Model T, which was released in October of that year, so everyone is driving around in those Mr. Burns-style automobiles that you have to crank by hand. You know the ones I'm talking about. The Mr. Toad from Wind in the Willows cars. Poop poop. So there's a woman driving along a bridge in Detroit when suddenly her engine dies. This is a very, very common problem with cars back then, because cars back then sucked, and the engines would just die at the drop of a hat. So this woman breaks down on this bridge. Now, there's no NRMA back then, so she has to wait for someone to come along to help her. But she's in luck. someone does indeed stop to assist her with her problem, because the age of chivalry was not yet dead in 1908 or something like that. I'm trying to weave a goddamn narrative here. As luck would have it, a gentleman by the name of Byron Carter is driving along the same bridge, and he stops to assist this lady with her troublesome automobile. And this is incredibly fortunate for the lady involved, because Byron Carter happens to be one of the founders of the Jacksonville Automobile Company. That is the best roadside assistance you're going to get in 1908. It's like if your laptop breaks down and the next person to wander over is Bill Gates. You know what? That bit is structurally better if I say Steve Jobs, but we all know that that guy was a fucking charlatan who didn't know how fruit worked, let alone the inside of an iPhone, so we're going to have to go with Bill Gates. So Byron Carter, automotive tycoon, takes a look at this lady's broken down car and says, "Yep, there's your problem. Engine's off. We're just going to have to give it a crank and away we go." If you're paying attention, this is quite possibly the first documented instance of mansplaining. So Carter leans down and he starts cranking this lady. Cars were cranked back then, don't be nasty. So Byron Carter is cranking away when the engine roars back into life and the crank takes on a life of its own. The crank spins so hard that it cracks Byron Carter in his face, shatters his skull, and puts him directly into the obituaries. That's the end of one of the founding fathers of the American automotive industry. Wham, bam, no thanks to you, ma'am. Sucks to be him, right? And that's where it could have ended. A demonstration of the random nature of a fickle universe. But unfortunately, this particular fatality is one of the weird fulcrums of history. It changes the world. Because one of Byron Carter's best friends was a dude by the name of Henry Leyland. Who is Henry Leyland, you ask? Well, Henry Leyland founded Cadillac. Yeah, everyone in the automotive industry knew each other back then. Leyland was so upset over his friend's death that he vowed to eliminate the need for hand cranks in cars from that point on, so that nobody would ever again be the victim of some impromptu automotive dental work. Henry Leyland, being the founder of Cadillac, had a bit of spare cash lying around, and he hired a scientist by the name of Charles Kettering. Does that name ring a bell? Charles Kettering set to work creating a self-starting car, and in 1911, we got the Cadillac Model 30. Imagine the cars that they drove in The Great Gatsby and you're in the ballpark. This Cadillac Model 30 was the bee's knees. It shat over everything else on the market. It was twice as powerful and twice as fast as the Ford Model T, for instance. And on the strength of the Model 30, Cadillac made more money than God. But the Model 30 had one major problem. It was deafeningly loud. This thing seriously sounded like the Franco-Prussian War. If I were writing that bit for a modern car, I would have said it sounded like World War III, but it is surprisingly hard to come up with an appropriate metaphor when World War I hasn't happened yet. So the Cadillac Model 30 is incredibly loud. Every time you turned it on, it sounded like you'd opened a portal directly to hell. And it's all because of the engines. Because the way an engine works is essentially a series of controlled explosions. So, super simply, here's how an internal combustion engine works. Don't at me, mechanics. You need three things to make a fire, and an explosion is just a lot of fire in a small amount of time. So you need fuel, you need heat, and you need oxygen. A piston inside a tube compresses some fuel, usually gasoline, and some air, which contains oxygen. The piston rams the mixture into a tight hole, don't be nasty, and then a spark plug ignites that fuel-air mix, and the resulting explosion pushes the piston back out, which turns some gears, which powers whatever needs powering. This pushes up the next piston, which does the same thing. You get these things operating in a sequence, and you can make a car go vroom. The problem the Cadillac M30 had was that it compressed the fuel way more than any other car on the market. It needed more power, so it used more compression. and it compressed that fuel mix so much that the fuel air mix would sometimes spontaneously explode on its own due to the pressure instead of being set off by a spark plug. When a piston fired off early, don't be nasty, it threw off the timing of the engine, which is bad because each piston is supposed to power the next one in the sequence. Everyone on board? Cool. So when these explosions started happening on their own and throwing off the functioning of the engines, it was called engine knock. Because the sound could be described, if you were being very generous, that sound could be described as knocking. And because marketing people decided it was a hell of a lot easier to sell the term engine knock instead of the term engine horrible wailing from a hell dimension made of explosions. So it's loud. It decreases fuel efficiency, it decreases power output, it damages the engine, it sounds like you're going to die. Engine knock is a bad thing. We need to get rid of that. And I think I need to stress just how much of a problem engine knock used to be. It was everywhere. It was so common that people didn't really think about it. Or more to the point, they couldn't conceive of a world without engine knock. That's just what cars sounded like. For a fun, interactive experience, go and watch some old cartoons. The original Disney cartoons or the old 1930s Looney Tunes with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. Those kind of cartoons. Whenever there's a car in those cartoons, it's always sputtering and making explosive sounds. That's engine knock. And now that I've pointed it out, you'll never unsee it. These cartoons always made cars sound sick because that's just what cars sounded like. They exploded. So how do we get rid of engine knock? That was the $6 million question for anyone who made cars back in the day. Back when Detroit was still known for making cars instead of being RoboCop come to life. And this is where you bring in the mad scientists. It turns out that engine knock goes away if you change the fuel mix. This whole problem happens because of pressure. Different fuels can sustain different amounts of compression before they spontaneously explode, and we tend to dislike things that spontaneously explode. The measure of how much fuel can be compressed before it explodes is known as the octane rating. Because scientists in the early 20th century noticed that fuels, which were high in the hydrocarbon known as octane, could be compressed way more than anything else, so they used that to calculate how much things could be squished before they exploded, and by extension, how good a fuel was. That's the octane rating. Octane itself has an octane rating of 100, which seems reasonable. I like to think that I have a demo rating of 100. Heptane has an octane rating of 0. Other chemicals have an octane rating somewhere between octane and heptane, and now everyone is confused because I've said ane so many times. But now you know what it means when someone advertises something as being high octane. I was recently at the Perth Fringe Festival, and someone there advertised his comedy show as being high octane fun, and I have to assume that that meant he could be substantially compressed before he exploded. Which I guess is true, but probably not what he was going for. I, myself, prefer to advertise my shows based on how funny I am, as opposed to my explosivity, but maybe people look for different qualities in their comedians. You do you. So high octane means that it will explode when you want it to explode, and low octane means that it will explode when it damn well feels like it. Octane, as you can imagine, like all premium substances, is not exactly cheap. The question becomes, how do we get high-octane results with low-octane prices? And this brings us to the scientician Charles Kettering. He's been tasked with coming up with a fuel that will eliminate engine knock by only exploding when you want it to explode. And Charles Kettering, being the capitalist that he was, decided that the best way to do this was to outsource the work. Kettering hired an assistant, a 27-year-old engineer by the name of Thomas Midgley Jr. And together, they accidentally started the end of the world. Again. So Charles Kettering had been tasked with creating an additive that will turn any fuel into a high-octane fuel. By extension, Thomas Midgley Jr. has now been tasked with creating an additive that will turn any fuel into a high-octane fuel. And Thomas Midgley Jr. immediately goes all mad scientist. In the age-old tradition of chemistry that we've seen so many times on this show, he starts just throwing shit at a wall and seeing what sticks. He goes the full Cave Johnson.
We haven't entirely nailed down what element it is yet, but I'll tell you this, it's a lively one, and it does not like the human skeleton.
Remember, this dude literally slept with a copy of the periodic table on him. And why do these elements exist if we're not going to try blowing them up? Camphor. Does that work? No? Okay, fine. We'll try something else. Okay, how about aluminium chloride? Nope. All right, how about melted butter? Damn, I'm sure that was going to work. Or, in Midgley's own words, most of them had no more effect than spitting in the Great Lakes. Because he was also a poet. And I'm not doing material there. He actually tried melted butter. So, alright, butter is out. That's a shame. But what if the reason that butter didn't work was because it was yellow? How about we try using an additive that is red? Because everyone knows that when you make something red, it goes faster. Again, not material, that actually happened. It's not as outlandish as it might sound, as stupid as it might seem in hindsight. There's reason in there somewhere. I'm painting Thomas Midgley Jr. as a villain, and I think rightfully so, but he wasn't an idiot. There's some science in play here.
I'll be honest, we're throwing science at the wall here to see what sticks. No idea what it'll do.
His thinking was that red colors might absorb more ambient radiation, and therefore control the point at which the fuel mix exploded. Which is actually a sound theory. We all know that color is the varying rates of either reflecting or absorbing radiation, namely visible light, so experimenting with color isn't as wild as I initially made it sound. Remember, all of science is this kind of fuck around and find out, and you don't find out without the fuck around. And also, if there's any kids listening, here's an important life lesson. It's only a mistake if you keep doing something that isn't working. Experimentation is crucial, so go out there and experiment. Just maybe stop if it looks like you're going to destroy the planet. Midgley and Kettering found a plant whose leaves were green on the top, but red on the underside. The Mayflower, if you must know. And this plant was able to grow in the snow because it absorbed that extra radiation through the red leaves. So they decided to try something similar with fuel. But how do you make fuel red? Well, you fuck around and find out. You find things that are red, and you melt them into your explosive fuel mixture, and you see if it explodes. Science! Thomas Midgley Jr. bought some iodine from a local chemist, and he put that in the fuel, and it turned red. And then he turned the engine on, and there was no knocking. He'd solved the problem. So obviously, red fuel doesn't experience engine knock, right? Actually, Midgley did not think that, because correlation does not equal causation. The knock didn't go away because the fuel was red, it was because of the iodine. The chemical composition of iodine changed the pressure point. So what followed was experimentation with chemicals similar to iodine. This led to ethyl iodide, which is similar to iodine, and that too solved the engine knock. But it also had the side effect of corroding the engine, which is bad. But Midgley knew that he was heading in the right direction. Midgley did find one substance that worked, that eliminated engine knocking, without corroding the engine. Ethanol. You know, alcohol. The stuff you get when you allow yeast to eat sugar. The stuff we've been making since the agricultural revolution 12,000 years ago. Ethanol makes a pretty decent high-octane fuel. Decent enough to solve the problem. Ethanol eliminated engine knock. Thomas Midgley Jr. had found the holy grail of the automotive industry. The problem was completely solved. A mixture of 10% ethanol would make engine knock a thing of the past, and we'd all have a wonderful knock-free future of cars that didn't explode at the drop of a hat. Except for one little detail. You see, all of this was happening in the United States of America. And the United States of America has a problem with sugar. Not the obesity crisis, although it also has that, but something even weirder. The US doesn't really use sugar. They haven't for a very long time. For reasons that we will get into one day, the United States has very little actual sugar usage. What they use instead are substitutes. These days it's mainly high fructose corn syrup. This is why most of the sweet things in the United States taste really weird to people from the rest of the world. We use sugar, and the Americans wouldn't know actual sugar if it bit them in the ass. For very complex reasons, the big money crop in the United States is corn. The vast proportion of their agriculture is corn-related. Part of this is tradition, part of it is crop availability, but for the most part, it's because the corn industry has all of the money and can lobby government to crush all other industries because US politics is fundamentally broken to the point where it looks like satire to the rest of the world. The long and the short of it is that while ethanol would completely solve the engine knock issue, it wasn't cost-effective to produce because the corn industry in the US had its foot on the throat of the sugar industry, and a very simple staple crop anywhere else on the planet was prohibitively expensive to use stateside. And we're going to need to take a moment here to pause and really appreciate that the problems I'm going to spend the rest of the show describing, they could have all been avoided by using a common plant. It's just that doing things the hard way and using a known poison instead of an edible crop made a small group of people richer than they already were, so that's the way that things went. Also, I said it's a 10% ethanol mixture. That 10% figure? We do not like that 10%. That means that people are only using 90% of the product that we're trying to sell. Is there any way that we can get an additive somewhere in the 1% range so that we can keep the other 99% for ourselves? That'd be great. Because capitalism is demonstrably the best socioeconomic system ever devised. So Thomas Midgley Jr. had to come up with an alternative to ethanol. Something that was cheap, easy to produce, and functional at less than the 10% ratio of ethanol. So he kept at the problem, and he made out with his periodic table some more, and he kept trying things. The next solution he came up with was tellurium. Because we paid for the whole periodic table, we're gonna damn well use the whole periodic table. Tellurium met all of the criteria, but it too had a problem. You see, tellurium, and they don't tell you this in science class, tellurium happens to smell exactly like rotten garlic. It is rank. Tellurium, by one of the weird quirks of the universe, just happens to smell like the worst fart in the world.
What about if it is stinking inside?
And the smell doesn't go away either. It clings to you. It gets into your clothes and your hair and your skin, and you can't wash it out. It takes months for the smell to work its way out of your skin as you wait for your skin to die. So while tellurium also solved engine knock, it was ruled out because it was
stinky.
As Thomas Midgley Jr. wrote, although this doubled the fuel economy, I don't think that humanity would suffer the smell. And as for Thomas Midgley Jr. himself, his wife refused to let him in the house, and he was forced to live in his basement for the duration of his experiments with tellurium. And once again, we could have had a non-poisonous solution to the engine knock problem, but never underestimate a man's need to fuck. So tellurium was out.
I think it's a good idea, and I'm on standby.
And then, on December the 3rd, 1921, Thomas Midgley Jr. found his solution. Tetraethyl lead. Tetraethyl lead was the holy grail that he was looking for. It stopped engine knock. It was cheap to produce, and it worked at one part in a thousand to be effective. So you didn't have to fight the corn industry, it didn't smell like a butt. Tetraethyl lead was where it was at. This was a eureka moment. Engine knock was now a thing of the past. From this point on, cars would no longer sound like they were about to explode all the time. As Thomas Midgley Jr. said to Charles Kettering, quote, Can you imagine how much money we're going to make with this? We're going to make $200 million, maybe even more. End quote. I kind of made up the accent there, but you get the idea. Adjusted for inflation, that's a shade over $3 billion in today money, which is quite a fair bit. Keep that quote in mind, because it's going to be crucial to character development later on. I don't know if you've picked up on the tone of this show yet or not, but Thomas Midgley Jr. was one of the biggest pieces of shit in history. Thomas Midgley Jr. and Charles Kettering, just like they did with their CFC Freon, patented the process for making this fuel, and together they became richer than an entire pantheon. Because you don't do science to make the world a better place, you do it to make yourself rich. Capitalism, baby, is there anything it can't do? They called their new product ethyl, which was kind of nice. It kind of sounds like your nan, doesn't it? It's a nice, friendly name, ethyl. It needs to be noted that nowhere on the brochure was there any mention of lead. Because even back then, they didn't want people knowing that this product was laced with something famously toxic. Oh, did we forget to mention the lead? Oopsie. Kettering and Midgley teamed up with three of the biggest fuel producers in the world: General Motors, DuPont Chemical, and the Standard Oil Company. And together, they formed the Ethyl Corporation to start getting this product out on the market and raking in the money. And again, no mention anywhere of the lead. We wouldn't want to worry people, right? That's going to be a bit of a theme. Ethyl, which is the brand name, remember, for leaded petrol, became the most sought-after product in the global automotive industry. And why wouldn't it? It completely solved a problem that was, until that point, synonymous with cars. Engine knock. To put that into perspective, the difference that this product made, ethyl, it's the equivalent of someone inventing an additive that makes ice cream burn calories. It's that huge. The Ethyl Corporation was printing money. For his discovery, Thomas Midgley Jr. won the fuel industry's highest award, the Nichols Award, and he was asked to do a series of talks all over the world to promote his new invention. Midgley, eternally humble, declined. He didn't do his press tour. Because Thomas Midgley Jr. knew something that the rest of the world did not. His new product, ethyl, which was short for tetraethyl lead, had lead in it. He'd been keeping quiet about the lead, because lead is highly toxic. Thomas Midgley Jr. was one of the few people in the world who knew that this new petroleum that everyone was using was pure fucking poison. Seriously, it will kill you. Horribly. Just in case you don't know, here's why lead poisoning is bad. And fair warning, enjoy not sleeping tonight because you have lead in your system right now. Because of Thomas Midgley Jr., all of you, everyone listening to this show right now and for a substantial time into the future, all of you are currently experiencing some form of lead poisoning. Thanks, Tommy. Lead is dangerous because the human body cannot tell the difference between lead and calcium. It's just a freak coincidence of nature that lead and calcium are pretty much twinsies as far as the body is concerned. So when you ingest lead, the body will say, "Fuck yeah, calcium, we need that for strong, healthy bones because the bones are the money." And it will start slotting lead in wherever you usually put calcium, like in your bones and your teeth. And it can stay there forever.
Exactly, the bones are the skeleton's money. In our world, bones equal dollars.
So if you consume enough lead, you can slowly Wolverine your own skeleton, replacing calcium with lead. Which is bad, but it's worse when the lead gets into the brain. Lead coats the neurons in your brain, and it stops them from absorbing neurotransmitters. That's why lead poisoning symptoms include headaches, memory loss, and tingling in the extremities. It rots your brain from the inside out. Remember when your parents said that television would rot your brain? Well, lead was quite literally rotting theirs when they said that. And lead poisoning is particularly bad for children, because those growing bodies are grabbing as much calcium as they can to grow strong, healthy bones, except they don't know that instead of calcium, they're getting lead. Also, they've got young brains which are trying to form neural connections every single day, and they can't because there's a toxic metal blocking their dendrites. All of this causes a whole slew of developmental problems in children, both physical and mental. Oh yeah, it also fucks with your emotional regulation too. People with lead poisoning are much more violent than the baseline, which is a fun little addition. And it's not like people didn't know that lead was poisonous. The Romans knew that lead was poisonous, to give you an idea of how far back that goes. It's not like contemporaneous people didn't know about the dangers of lead. It's not like Midgley's other invention, CFCs, where the effects were inconceivable and wouldn't be apparent for decades. There were a lot of people all over the world absolutely fucking horrified about what was going on. And they were powerless to stop it because capitalism guards all the doors and holds all the keys, and this product was making a shitload of money. In 1925, the world's leading expert on lead, Dr. Alice Hamilton, pleaded with Thomas Midgley Jr. and Charles Kettering to please, pretty please, with a cherry on top, not put lead in petrol because of the untold destruction it would wreak. They did it anyway. She essentially said, don't do this, you're going to kill millions of people. You're putting a known neurotoxin inside something which emits vapors inside major population centers, and they did it anyway. Or to use Dr. Alice Hamilton's actual words, quote, I am not one to believe that the use of this so-called leaded gasoline can ever be made safe. No lead industry has ever, even under the strictest control, lost all its dangers. Where there is lead, some case of lead poisoning sooner or later develops, even under the strictest supervision. End quote. But Thomas Midgley Jr. was making the equivalent of $3 billion, so he had exactly zero fucks to give. So the world kept using tetraethyl lead. But fuck damn, doesn't it stop engine knock like nothing else? Except for ethanol and tellurium, but aside from those, it's absolutely the best at stopping engine knock, so let's keep pumping lead into the atmosphere and poisoning billions of people. Fuck them for being poor. If you die from lead poisoning, it's your own fault. To keep up with demand, the Ethyl Chemical Corporation had to build a new refinery in New Jersey just to make enough leaded petrol to supply the world's needs. Within a few months of opening, dozens of this plant's workers fell ill with lead poisoning, and five of them died. Five people died from making this stuff, and everyone was just out there in the wild breathing it in. So all of this horrible lead poisoning, that's got to be bad for business, right? Well, usually. People still smoke and play poker machines despite there being literally no upsides, so I can't go all in on Midgley here, but it's not a good look. Lead poisoning was indeed bad for business. Something needed to be done. So Thomas Midgley Jr. held a press conference to dispel the idea that tetraethyl lead was bad for you. What a preposterous idea! Well, I never! Remember in the last show when I said that Midgley was a showman? Remember when he demonstrated that CFCs were safe by inhaling some and then blowing it out over an open flame? Well, he's going to roll out the hits here. Thomas Midgley Jr. assembled the world's press to demonstrate that there is absolutely nothing wrong with ethyl, and all of this hysteria about lead poisoning was simply nonsense. Thomas Midgley Jr. took out a beaker of tetraethyl lead and poured it all over his arms and his hands. He bathed in it. And then, with great ostentation, he raised his cupped hands to his face and he took a huge breath of the stuff. He huffed it in. In fact, he kept breathing it for a full minute to demonstrate how safe the product was. "I'm not taking any chance whatsoever," he said. "Nor would I take any chance doing that every day." That's a quote, direct quote from Thomas Midgley Jr., and he had indeed been doing that every day. And the press, God bless them, they took Thomas Midgley Jr. at his word. Mollified, they went back to their various newspapers and radio stations with nothing but glowing reviews of this new wonder product. "Nothing to see here. Climate change, lead poisoning, is fake news." They didn't think it was weird that Thomas Midgley Jr., upon winning his numerous awards for discovering leaded petrol, one of the most famous and respected scientists in the world, one of the richest people in the world, at the absolute height of his fame and his prestige, nobody thought it was strange that he didn't do a tour about his discovery. He didn't go from university to university lecturing about his new invention, extolling its virtues, reveling in his fame and his prestige. In fact, nobody questioned why Thomas Midgley Jr., upon releasing such a world-changing invention, seemed to completely disappear off the face of the earth for 6 months. It would take nearly a century before the Fourth Estate finally discovered that Thomas Midgley Jr. spent the better part of the entire year of 1923 in a clinic in Florida recovering from the effects of acute lead poisoning. That trick of washing himself in petrol and huffing on the fumes, Thomas Midgley Jr. made such a show about that because he knew he could only do that trick once. If he tried it again, he was going to die. Nobody in history was more aware of the dangers of lead. Nobody in the world stayed further away from leaded petrol than Thomas Midgley Jr. Because nobody else in the world had a better idea of exactly how fucking dangerous this shit was. But Thomas Midgley Jr. wanted to be rich, so he unleashed it anyway. He just made sure he wasn't anywhere near it. A true Tory to the end, rules for thee, not for me. A whole bunch of doctors and scientists and entire universities wrote to Thomas Midgley Jr. and Charles Kettering warning them of the dangers of using lead, naively assuming that they didn't know how harmful it was, and Kettering and Midgley just ignored them. There was just too much money in it. And it needs to be abundantly clear that unlike with chlorofluorocarbons, this time they knew exactly what evil they were unleashing on the world, and they did it anyway. Following the Second World War, manufacturing boomed, and cars were one of the boom industries. Car usage grew exponentially, and it grew all over the world. Soon there were millions of cars, and then tens of millions, then hundreds of millions of automobiles all over the world, each and every one of them spewing a dangerous neurotoxin into the air every second it was in use. Car usage grew beyond exponentially, it was cataclysmic. And that's even without touching on how utterly predatory the automotive industry is. For more on that, I highly recommend seeking out either Strong Towns or Not Just Bikes, but suffice it to say that the automotive industry managed to shape the 20th century better than anyone else and position the world so that society was forced to bend to the whims of the automobile, with entire countries built around cars and, by extension, more brain-melting poisons being belched into the atmosphere every day. There was so much lead in the air that it eventually found its way into everything, literally every substance on Earth, up to and including the innocuous zircon samples that one Claire Patterson was trying to use to determine the age of the planet. Which brings us back where we needed to be. Patterson was trying to determine the age of the planet by using uranium and lead inside zircon. But his experiments were always tainted with lead from other sources. Way more lead than there should have been. Alarming amounts of lead. Patterson tried to find ways to purify his samples and free them from the taint of background lead levels, but it was impossible. He scrubbed down his lab and he stripped anything even remotely lead from it. His experiments were still tainted. He invented the idea of a clean room, a hermetically sealed chamber with negative air pressure, completely removed from the outside world. There was still lead. Do you ever find yourself inventing a new standard in biocontainment just to try and get unbiased zircon readings? Because that's what Claire Patterson had to do. But for all of his efforts, eventually Patterson realized that there was no way to scrub the background lead enough to get decent readings from any terrestrial material. There was simply too much lead everywhere in the atmosphere at every point on the globe that he had no way to conduct this research. Patterson ended up having to use meteors to calculate the half-life of uranium and determine the age of the Earth. He found meteors that were formed at the same time as the Earth, back when all of the planets were knocking into each other like billiard balls, and using these meteor samples, Patterson was able to determine that the Earth was 4.55 billion years old, or about a billion years older than anyone previously thought. He managed to get a precise date on the age of the planet, so hurrah for science, woo! So he's got that going for him, and that would have been enough to etch himself into history forever. And Patterson would have been happy with that. That's a great achievement, and more than enough to get a PhD. But just like Sherwood and Molina with Midgley's other invention, Freon, Claire Patterson was slightly more alarmed by the apocalyptic amount of neurotoxin in the Earth's atmosphere. So now, with the age of the Earth resolved, Patterson found himself with a new mission in life. He was going to put a stop to this, the second of Thomas Midgley Jr.'s attempts to destroy mankind. And, as you can probably imagine, Claire Patterson was not well received at all, especially by the petroleum industry, because of all the, you know, obscene amounts of money that people were making. Hard evidence of the destruction of mankind is one thing, but on the other hand, money. You can see the dilemma that Big Oil found themselves in. Frank Howard, the president of Standard Oil, said, quote, "We do not feel justified in giving up what has come to the industry like a gift from heaven on the possibility that a hazard may be involved in it." End quote. The petroleum industry said that lead was all natural, just like asbestos, so what are you complaining about? You're going to try and tell us that asbestos is unhealthy too? Get out of here, hippie. Just to be clear, Frank Howard knew that this was a major ecological disaster, he just liked money more. The various petroleum and petroleum-adjacent industries of the world did not like the idea of having to regulate their industry and their profits, so predictably, they started their own counter-campaign about how awesome leaded petrol is. Lead is all natural, you find it in the ground, so there's nothing wrong with lead. We've been using it for years and everything is great. The world is supposed to have that much lead in it, and children are supposed to have that many tumors in them. It's the circle of life. The same thing with CFCs was going to have to happen with leaded petrol. Claire Patterson was going to have to go out on his own and do his own personal epic of Gilgamesh to try and find the kind of incontrovertible evidence that would shut up the capitalists. Specifically, he had to go out quite literally to the middle of the ocean, as far away from humans as he could possibly get. Patterson figured that if high lead levels were all natural, like Captain Dickhead of the petroleum industry claimed, then they'd be consistent at all depths of the ocean, away from human interference. But if these high lead levels were something that only happened post-Thomas Midgley Jr. fucking with the planet, then they'd taper off the further down the ocean you went. So Patterson summoned his inner James Cameron and went spelunking.
Music on!
His name is James Cameron, the bravest pioneer. No budget too steep, no sea too deep. Who's that? It's him, James Cameron.
And wouldn't you know it, once you got down into the depths of the ocean, there was no lead to speak of. All of these abnormally high lead levels in the atmosphere, in the water, in the dirt, they were all 100% the Midge. So next, Patterson had to prove that these high lead levels were a recent thing, as in the life and times of Thomas Midgley Jr. recent. And this bit, well, there's no other way to put it. Claire Patterson summoned some mummies. There's a sentence I didn't expect to say today. Patterson compared the lead levels in the bones of recently deceased persons and contrasted those to measurements he took from Mesoamerican and Egyptian mummies that were loaned to him from various museums who kept such things. And apologies to anyone who thought I was going to bust out the Necronomicon there, I may have gilded the lily a bit there.
Hail, brothers! Coronan Sileria Ozumahok!
Mohawk!
Claire Patterson expected the lead levels in modern humans to be about 100 times more concentrated than those of the mummies, based on his rather pessimistic assumptions about lead exposure. And they were not 100 times more concentrated than those of people in the past. They were over 1,000. People in the modern era have over 1,000 times the amount of lead in them than anyone living prior to the 20th century. And to put that into perspective, remember that there is no safe level of lead exposure. Nil. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. Any lead in your system is bad for you. It's just a matter of degrees, but the smallest speck of lead in your body will be doing some kind of damage, and it just ramps up from there. The current World Health Organization guidelines for a relatively safe amount of lead in your bloodstream considers anything above 3.5 micrograms per deciliter to be toxic. Back in the 1960s, the lead industry assured people that 60 micrograms was just fine and peachy. Healthy, even. 20 times the recommended level. And thanks to the efforts of the oil and petroleum industries and the science of Thomas Midgley Jr. and Charles Kettering, everyone on the planet has some amount of lead in them. The older you are, the more lead you have in you, and anyone over the age of 50 has a very dangerous amount of lead in them simply because they existed in a time before we started clamping down on this. And I will say it again for emphasis, a substance that has been known to be profoundly toxic for thousands of years. Lead poisoning is responsible for 2/3 of all unexplained mental issues globally. There is still so much lead in the air, even today, that it's just easier for doctors to assume that someone has lead poisoning and then amend the forms later if, after some tests, the symptoms point to something else. Lead poisoning is the go-to. It causes skin conditions, respiratory problems, heart failure, and holy motherfucking Christ, does it cause a cornucopia of mental illnesses. If you plot the incidences of violent crime in the United States over the last century, and I use the US because they have a larger data set, but you can see the same effects wherever you look. If you plot the incidences of violent crime over the years, you see a steady increase in violent crime year by year by year until it peaks in the early 1990s. This is the infamous 90s crime wave that made a lot of people think that the world was ending and Mad Max was near, so nail a corpse to your souped up hot rod and prepare your body for the Thunderdome, the lawless dystopia is upon us. Listeners my age and older, you'll get what I'm talking about. Younger kids, we will get around to it one day, but I'm already running long. What's interesting, though, is that if you take this graph of the rise in violent crime and overlay it against a graph of the average lead exposure of infants over time, it's exactly the same graph, just 20 years later. Or, approximately, the amount of time it takes for a mentally compromised toddler to become old enough to commit a violent crime and then be tried as an adult. I'm using the US here because that's where Thomas Midgley Jr. was from and I like big data sets, but in case you thought this was a spurious correlation, you can do exactly the same thing with crime rates and lead exposure in Britain, Canada, and Australia. Pick anywhere, it's the same thing. Because of the lead being spewed into the atmosphere by leaded gasoline, people's brains were being melted, and they became irrational, paranoid, and hateful as the lead coated their dendrites and prevented synapses from firing. So lead gets into your bones, it kills your brain cells, it makes you stupid and violent. There's something else it does too, it hardens your arteries. Lead is pretty much the same as high cholesterol, it gives you heart problems, and asthma, and eczema. If you throw a dart at a copy of Grey's Anatomy, you're probably going to hit something that's caused by lead poisoning. Thomas Midgley Jr.'s decision to use lead in gasoline instead of ethanol has directly led to the deaths of over 100 million people globally over the last century. And that number is still going up. To put it into perspective, Hitler comes in at about 10% of that. And remember, Hitler plateaued in 1945. Midgley is still killing people. Thomas Midgley Jr. knew that lead was toxic. He knew it was incredibly dangerous, and it would ripple over the decades, potentially centuries, and he did it anyway because it made him very, very rich. Over 100 million people have died as a direct result of Thomas Midgley Jr.'s decision to use lead as an engine knock agent. Billions more have suffered some kind of sickness that could have been avoided if Midgley had gone with one of the other ingredients that he knew worked. And he knew the entire time. And he did it anyway. Millions of deaths, billions of injuries, both still climbing. And that huge number, take that and add it to all of the people who have been maimed or killed by the hole in the ozone layer caused by Thomas Midgley Jr.'s other big invention, chlorofluorocarbons. There is, categorically, no bigger killer in history than Thomas Midgley Jr. It's not even close. I won't go into the fight that Claire Patterson had on his hands to convince the world that leaded petrol was a toxic menace destroying mankind. Partially because I want to keep the powder dry, partially because you can find it better elsewhere, but mostly because it's depressingly similar to everything I spoke about in the last show. It's almost a chorus. He says that lead is bad. Big Petroleum says it's good. He presents evidence. They say alternative facts. There are lawsuits and congressional hearings and decades of misery for someone trying to stop the children of Earth from being melted from the inside out by something, again, known to be highly toxic for thousands of years.
Agent Malone, Environmental Protection Agency. Some Boy Scouts stumbled on your little game of hide the ooze.
Eventually, Claire Patterson succeeded, but it damn near broke him. You know the story. Even if you don't know the story, you know the story, because it's exactly the same story every fucking time. The first country to ban leaded fuel was Japan in 1986. The rest of the world slowly followed suit. The last was Algeria in 2021. According to data from the United Nations, the elimination of leaded petrol saves an estimated 1 million lives every year. 1 million people every single year. By transitive property, Thomas Midgley Jr.'s invention is killing a million people every single year. That's two Stalins worth of murders in between the time when the first country banned his invention and the last. Currently, right at this very moment, there are over 800 million children in the world with blood lead levels above 5 micrograms. Remember, 3.5 is considered dangerous. Most of these children are from poorer or developing countries where environmental laws are more of a guideline than an actual rule.
And thirdly, the code is more what you'd call guidelines than actual rules.
Every single person on the planet alive after Thomas Midgley Jr. invented leaded gasoline has some amount of brain damage because of it. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not doing a bit. That's the cold, hard truth of it. Every single person. Me. You. Your family. Your friends. Everyone you've ever met, ever seen, ever heard of. Anyone alive at any point in the last century has Thomas Midgley Jr. to thank for the lead that is in their body. Baby boomers copped it the worst. They were the first generation born into a world with leaded petrol, and they got to live through all of it. Across the board, all baby boomers are, on average, 5 IQ points dumber than the generation before them or the generations to come after. And it goes a long, long way to explaining all of the problems with the baby boomer generation. Think of every issue that stems from boomer policy and now reframe it with the context that they've been inhaling a mood-altering, neuron-destroying toxin literally every day of their entire lives. Oh, you're a baby boomer and you're not brain damaged, you say? Well, sorry, but you are. That's just an incontrovertible fact. I'm sorry, but it's true. You're functional, sure, but your brain is not in mint condition. I'm not saying that you're dumb. I'm not saying you're stupid. I'm saying that you are, on average, 5 IQ points below where you would have been if Thomas Midgley Jr. had never existed. That was taken from you. That was stolen from you. And you should be absolutely fucking outraged. Do an IQ test. IQ tests are generally bullshit. They don't test intelligence, merely pattern recognition. But for the sake of the argument, do an IQ test. Whatever number you get, add 5 to it. That's where you'd be without the midge. As Zach Wiener-Smith of Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal said, Thomas Midgley Jr. made achieving a human-level AI intelligence slightly easier. Which is a great joke, however, it's not mine. I include it because it was pointed out to me by Grant, who is an ardent supporter of the show and has been for a very long time, and I feel kind of guilty for doing so much German accent work in my live show when I didn't know that he brought along a German friend, so hopefully this balances out the comic scales. You have to admit that that routine was a fucking banger though, right?
No one who speaks German could be an evil man.
Things begin to improve with Generation X, as the world started figuring out that lead was bad, mainly thanks to the tireless work of Claire Patterson. In my generation, millennials, the brain damage begins to go away as leaded petrol is phased out, but it's still there. I'm an older millennial, and I remember growing up with leaded petrol. I remember my grandfather refusing to trust unleaded petrol because of all of those years of propaganda and cultural inertia. I remember the switch to ethanol, and I remember it didn't happen until I was already an adult. I'm a smart guy, but I would have been even smarter if Thomas Midgley Jr. was never born, and if I ever get my hands on a time machine, I am going to travel back in time and brutally murder him in a way that will give me nightmares. Once more, for effect, all of you, each and every one of you, you are not as smart as you could have been because of the invention of leaded petrol. You should all be very angry indeed. And if you ever find yourself in possession of a time machine, before you go and set it to Austria at the turn of the 20th century, there's another destination I can think of where you could do a lot more good for the world. You might be wondering whatever became of Thomas Midgley Jr. And that is a great question. Pat yourself on the back for asking that. Because Thomas Midgley Jr. invented many things in his life. But he is famous for 3 inventions in particular. We've already discussed 2 of these inventions in great detail. The 2 that nearly destroyed the Earth. Leaded gasoline and chlorofluorocarbons. But there is another. This one's a bit more personal. In 1940, at the age of 51, Thomas Midgley Jr. contracted polio.
Oh, that's right, I'm crippled.
15 years before the vaccine was released. And we should all be thankful that it was Jonas Salk and not Thomas Midgley Jr. who created the polio vaccine. Salk wanted it to be freely available to anyone on the planet to wipe out this deadly disease as a basic human right. I would bet my left testicle that Thomas Midgley Jr. would have tried to monetize it. So Thomas Midgley Jr. contracted polio, which deprived him of the use of his legs, which is what polio does.
Oh, that's right, I'm crippled.
In some wonderfully cosmic irony, the amount of lead in Midgley's system would have left him more susceptible to polio and more likely to feel the symptoms of it. Karma is a bitch. Thomas Midgley Jr. was left crippled. This did not sit well with him. Thomas Midgley Jr. was, after all, a man of action, a man of science. What was it that fellow inventor Cave Johnson said when life gives you lemons?
Make life rue the day it thought it could give Cave Johnson lemons. Do you know who I am? I'm the man who's gonna burn your house down with the lemons. I'm gonna get my engineers to invent a combustible lemon that burns your house down.
Crippled with polio and restricted to a bed, unable to enjoy life, Thomas Midgley Jr. had all the time in the world to think. So he set his scientific mind to the problem of polio and how he might solve his mobility issues. After all, if there was anyone who could invent their way out of polio, it was Thomas Midgley Jr. And credit where due, he absolutely did. Midgley's invention made sure that he was never again troubled by the effects of polio. Since he was bedridden by polio, Midgley invented himself a new kind of bed. A bed that would allow him to be almost as self-sufficient as he had been before the polio. He designed a bed that looked like a Rube Goldberg contraption of ropes and pulleys and gears, and by pulling on various levers, he could operate his hospital bed like a 1940s Jaeger mech, positioning himself where he wanted to be. It was really a remarkable feat of engineering. He turned his sick bed into a 1940s block-and-tackle-powered Gundam. It's worth taking a look at the schematics of this thing. It's a truly impressive piece of machinery. But you gotta remember that this thing was designed by Thomas Midgley Jr. And everything Thomas Midgley Jr. invented was unintentionally deadly. On November the 2nd, 1944, while exercising his self-sufficiency and without any nursing staff around, Thomas Midgley Jr. found himself tangled in the internecine web of the device he had created. The more he tried to escape, the more he found himself caught up in the gears and the ropes of the machine he invented. One of the ropes wrapped itself around his neck, and the weight of his body pulled it taut. He struggled, but the ropes just pulled tighter. Thomas Midgley Jr., over the course of his life, inadvertently killed hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions of people. And yet, somehow, he managed to put himself at the top of that list. I will say one positive thing about Thomas Midgley Jr. He's the only person in history to kill Thomas Midgley Jr. 70 years after his death, New Scientist would look back at the life and times of Thomas Midgley Jr. and describe him as, quote, a one-man environmental disaster. He was, quite simply, the most destructive person who ever lived. And not even Thomas Midgley Jr. could escape the disastrous inventions of Thomas Midgley Jr. Midgley never set out to destroy the planet and murder billions of people, as far as I can tell. He had no idea that his invention of CFCs would put all of life on Earth in jeopardy. Nobody saw that coming. Nobody could have possibly seen that coming. It was simply inconceivable. Literally, nobody could imagine it. And Midgley was long dead before the effects of CFCs began to make themselves known. It wasn't him pushing back against CFC reform. It was the chemical companies like DuPont. But that doesn't make him any less responsible. Merely not as culpable. It might not have been him pushing a dangerous counter-narrative in this instance, but the 1980s crop of chemical executives were working off a playbook that Thomas Midgley Jr. had himself written in the 20s and 30s and 40s, when he would stand up in front of a crowd and blow Freon out over a candle, or huff a beaker of leaded petrol and then disappear for nearly a year to recover from the effects of lead poisoning, without anyone the wiser. It might not have been him doing it for CFCs, but that dangerous propaganda was yet another of his inventions. But when it came to leaded petrol, he is one of history's biggest monsters. Because nobody in the world, not a single soul, had more of an idea of how dangerous lead was, and how dangerous it would continue to be in the long term. Thomas Midgley Jr. spent many months of his life deathly ill from the very product he was insisting was perfectly safe, and he still pushed it anyway. And in that regard, the blood of every single life ruined by lead is directly on his hands. So, to answer a question from long ago, If you had a time machine and you could travel back in time and smother someone in the crib, which particular person would provide the most net benefit to humanity? Undoubtedly, it would be Thomas Midgley Jr. And, helpfully, he even designed a bed that would make it look like an accident. Oh, awesome. It is great to get that one out of the system. As I said in the last show, I've been sitting on this one for a while, and it's always nice to clear out the backlog. Also, I'm beginning to shy away from the multi-part series. I have no idea how Uncle Dan does it. Maybe it's the ADD in me, but I get really bored and I want to move on to other projects. So it's going to be nice to do something different for a change. It's been a while since we did some ancient history. How about we go back to our roots? Thank you to everyone for their support. I really appreciate it. Here's the obligatory call to action that we all have to do. So like, subscribe, share. It really helps. You might not think it helps, but it really does. It helps a lot. So if you feel that I've earned a thumbs up, then please thumb that up button. I've already plugged the Patreon, but here's a second effort for that. I do this show for free, and I always will. But I would like to remind everyone that as far as you know, I am a real human who needs to eat. And Patreon is absolutely the best way to help with that if you were so inclined. Among other things, you get a bonus show every month. Patrons are about to get an insight into a mini version of Thomas Midgley Jr. by the name of Leo Bakerlund. So if you want in on that, head over to Patreon. Links to everything that need linking to are over at my Linktree /HistoryGoTime. I am not hard to find. And please, feel free to keep hitting me up with those show ideas. It is awesome. Once upon a time, I wondered if I'd run out of ideas for shows, but you guys keep hitting me with absolute bangers. So shine on, you crazy diamonds. Catch you on the flip side.